No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Your voice matters, and our shows are hosted and produced by students and community members like you. You are CJSF.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CHLY in Nanaimo, CIVL in Abbotsford, CKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from a progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we unpack August 10th standoff between Air Canada and its 10,000 flight attendants on press progress sources. Speak with Manitoba Senator Mary Lou McFedrin about how she and others in the Senate are calling on the government to implement punitive measures against Israel on Green Planet Monitor. Break down how to understand the Hockey Canada trial and its implications on the end of sport, and explain why Prime Minister Carney's historic military spending hike will only benefit the weapons lobby on The Breach Show. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged, launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban. Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, and newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, the MB Media Co-op in Moncton, The Independent in St. John's, plus national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and many more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And now, since launching in October 2022, Sources provided in-depth interviews with experts and newsmakers across the country from the award-winning journalists at Press Progress. On this excerpt from a new episode, Labour reporter Emma Arkell in Vancouver joins editor Luke LeBrun in Ottawa to unpack the tense August standoff between Air Canada and its 10,000 flight attendants. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
This week, Air Canada and its 10,000 flight attendants announced that they had negotiated a deal to end a major strike that grounded flights across Canada over the weekend. But before reaching that deal, Air Canada was publicly attacking its own workers on social media, and then Mark Carney's government stepped in and invoked a controversial section of the Canada Labour Code to order flight attendants back to work. This led to the union representing Air Canada's flight attendants to vow that they were going to defy the back-to-work order, and Labour leaders declared that they were prepared to go to jail to defend their members' right to strike. Needless to say, the Air Canada flight attendant strike has been one of the most charged labor disputes in Canada's recent history. On today's episode of Sources, we're speaking with Press Progress's labor reporter, Emma Arkell, who is going to explain and unpack what exactly happened. So please, fasten your seatbelts and make sure your seat is in a full upright position. Emma Arkell is here today on Sources. Emma, before we get into the weeds on this Air Canada flight attendant strike and all the things that have happened over the last few weeks, can you tell us a little bit about who exactly went on strike, which kinds of workers at Air Canada were involved?
Well, this strike was by the Air Canada component of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, or QP, as they are often called. These are flight attendants at Air Canada, and that is a predominantly female workforce. One interesting part of this is that they are renegotiating a 10-year collective agreement. These are extremely unusual, and this one was negotiated a decade ago when we were in a much less labor action friendly environment. People really wanted labor stability at that point. And so the Harper government preemptively banned strikes in the airline sector. And then both the pilots and the flight attendants went for 10-year agreements.
And so what were some of the key issues and points of tension for flight attendants ahead of negotiations this time around?
These negotiations were really around pay. So both wages and unpaid work. Air Canada flight attendants, especially entry-level flight attendants, have, surprisingly low wages. Over the past 20 years, entry-level flight attendant wages have only gone up by around $3 an hour, according to QP. And so that means that those entry-level flight attendants earn just $27,000 a year before taxes, which is below the federal minimum wage. Another big issue in this dispute is unpaid work and the issue of ground pay.
Right. Yeah. So this issue of ground pay, or, you know, relating to what's called groundwork, was one of the central issues in this labor dispute. Can you explain for listeners who aren't aware, what exactly do flight attendants do when they're on the ground before a flight? Can you give us some specific examples of what sorts of tasks would be involved in groundwork?
Sure. Well, I mean, we've watched flight attendants do all of this work. If you have taken a flight, you have seen flight attendants do safety checks, help people board the plane, help people with their carry-on luggage, help elderly flyers or people with disabilities board the plane safely. All of that work, as well as work after the flight has landed, is unpaid, which I think people would be really surprised to learn. And that is obviously quite significant work. QP says flight attendants perform about 35 hours of groundwork per month, and all of that is unpaid. And when I spoke to flight attendants on the picket line on Monday, especially ones who had been in the industry around like 30 years, they said that the amount of groundwork that they have had to do has increased tenfold, because there are more passengers on planes. Part of this is also the fact that people are not checking luggage as much anymore. They're bringing their luggage onto the flight with them because they're trying to avoid those checked baggage fees that none of us want to pay. And there are also just more passengers who require assistance. So the amount of unpaid work that flight attendants have had to do has gone up quite significantly.
That's interesting. I know from listening to people talk about this issue that a lot of people are expressing surprise at learning that flight attendants are only paid for the work they do once the doors close and the plane is up in the air. But this has been a pretty standard industry practice for decades, if not, I mean, going back to the origins of air travel, I guess. Can you give us some background on this practice, and what are other airlines doing when it comes to ground pay?
Yeah, this is absolutely a long-standing industry practice, but flight attendants that I spoke to on the picket line said that that is starting to change. And one also added that just because it's a long-standing practice doesn't mean it's right. There are a couple other airlines that offer ground pay. Porter is one of them. And interestingly enough, this news kind of got buried in everything about Air Canada that happened recently, but QP announced on Friday morning that cabin crew at Porter have unionized with QP. And so the union now represents 1,200 cabin crew, which brings QP's total cabin crew membership in Canada to around 20,000 workers. Labor experts that I spoke to about this dispute told me that the days of unpaid groundwork are limited, and especially now that this issue has been brought by QP at Air Canada, Air Canada being our country's biggest airline, those workers are really in a position to set a new standard for the industry.
I want to turn our attention to the labor dispute itself. As I mentioned in the introduction, over the last week or two, we've seen Air Canada take a combative tone with its flight attendants. We've seen the union crashing a press conference. We've seen the federal government intervene and order flight attendants back to work. We've seen defiant union leaders say they're willing to go to jail. And then then after, you know, all of this, we end up having a deal on Monday in the early hours of the day. Emma, you know, we're recording this podcast on Thursday, August 21st. Can you walk us through the timeline of how we got here and where do things currently stand?
Yeah, I can do my best. Things happened very quickly over the weekend and at the beginning of the week. But all of this, you know, kind of started 8 months ago with negotiations that began in December 2024. The 10-year contract for flight attendants expired on March 31st. And a couple weeks ago, they held a strike vote in which 99.7% of membership who voted in favor of strike, which is an extremely strong strike mandate. Last week, the union filed a strike notice. Air Canada filed a lockout notice. And also Air Canada asked the government to step in with a Section 107 order to prevent labor disruption and to send the parties to binding arbitration, which the union was not interested in doing. The airline, in their statement, specifically pointed to recent government interventions in rail, port, and airline labor disruptions in Canada that they said provide a proven precedent for the government to step in. QP was not happy with this. They launched an air war campaign against Air Canada. Maybe you saw the website, the podcast, the social media accounts. Unfair Canada, I think, is one of the slogans. Unpaid work won't fly, I think, is another. As you mentioned, there were dueling press conferences. The union interrupted Air Canada's press conference and got it cut short. And then QP went on strike very early on Saturday morning. And less than 12 hours later, there was a return to work order from the government utilizing Section 107, which is a part of the Canada Labor Code. And the union said, too bad. They're not going back to work. They're going to stay on strike. And so there were pickets and rallies on the weekend. On Monday morning, the Canada Industrial Relations Board ruled the strike unlawful, and the union held strong and said, we don't care if it's unlawful. That's the point. We don't think we should have to go back to work or to binding arbitration. They want a deal at the table. And so there were pickets all day Monday. The picket that I visited at Vancouver International Airport was extremely spirited. People were out in really strong numbers. There was a lot of energy and also a lot of support from people at the airport, travelers, taxi drivers, and Uber drivers who were picking people up. The energy was fantastic. And I think staying strong and staying on the picket line is the reason why they went back to the bargaining table on Monday, and why, as of Tuesday morning, we've got a tentative agreement that flight attendants will vote on starting August 27th.
Right. So as you said, you know, a big flashpoint in this labor dispute was when the Carney government stepped in and invoked Section 107 of the Canada Labor Code to order the flight attendants back to work. Emma, can you explain, like, what is Section 107? Why is this so controversial? Just in the middle of publishing an explainer on this very subject, you've spoken with some labor experts. Can you walk us through this Section 107?
Sure. I have been talking to labor academics about Section 107 since I started this job a few months ago, because this has come up in a number of disputes in recent history. The government used Section 107 three times last year between August and November, I believe, maybe August and December, to send railway, longshoremen, and postal workers back to the job amidst their strikes and lockouts. And this is a little bit different than typical back-to-work legislation. If the government is going to pass standard back-to-work legislation, that actually needs to be passed in Parliament. They need to bring it to the other parties and have a debate about it. And that sort of opens it up to become a political football that can be really tough to handle for a minority government, especially. And both Justin Trudeau and Mark Carney have minority governments. Trudeau's government was, you know, held up by the supply and confidence agreement with the NDP, and the NDP is extremely unlikely to support back to work legislation. So it's understandable why they would not want to go the standard route. So instead, they've been using 107, which, as I said, is just a part of the Canada Labor Code. The language of 107 is extremely vague. It gives the minister the ability to do things that they feel are necessary in order to secure industrial peace. They can order the Canada Industrial Relations Board to do things for that industrial peace. It really leaves it wide open. And the Liberal government has a pattern of using it to end strikes and lockouts and send workers back to work. And this pattern has led to employers feeling encouraged not to settle at the bargaining table because they know that the government will step in and put an end to the strike, sometimes before it even begins or just 12 hours into the strike in the case of the flight attendants. And Air Canada made that extremely clear in this dispute. In an interview with BNN Bloomberg on Monday, Air Canada CEO Michael Rousseau said the company didn't make provisions to ensure passengers wouldn't be stranded in the event of a strike because the company expected the federal government to step in with 107 to avoid a job action. He even said, "We thought obviously that Section 107 would be enforced and that the union wouldn't illegally avoid Section 107. And to Air Canada's surprise, and I think also the government's surprise, QP did not obey that, and they stayed on strike.
There was an excerpt from a recent episode of Press Progress Sources. Find out more at pressprogress.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2016, Green Planet Monitor features news and stories on global environment, development, science, and social justice issues hosted by longtime Canadian public radio journalist David Kattenberg in Amsterdam. On this highlight from a new episode, David speaks with Manitoba Senator Mary Lou McFedrin about how she's calling on Prime Minister Mark Carney to uphold international law and implement punitive measures against Israel for its genocide in Gaza. Now, here's the show.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, cold as ice, as U.S.-backed Israeli forces terrorize Gaza, reducing the tiny enclave to rubble, Donald Trump's paramilitary militia terrorizes Black, Brown, and Latino communities coast to coast. We speak with an organizer for anti-war and justice group, Code Pink, and two dozen Canadian senators call for a comprehensive arms embargo on Israel. We speak with one of them. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Into Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, the death toll rising, famine has now been formally declared by the UN agency that declares such things, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC. It's a worst-case scenario, the IPC declared at the end of July. No news for those who follow the media. Skeletal toddlers on TV screens and online news platforms day after day. It's not true, says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, indicted for war crimes by the International Criminal Court. Israel's fast friends appear to be moved and are now declaring the horror show has to stop. Dangerous, they say. Inhumane. Unacceptable. Egregious. Outrageously unlawful? No. No Western state has gone that far. No mention of the G word or the A word. But a sea change seems to be underway in places you'd least expect. The UK, the Netherlands, Germany, and Canada. Longtime Israeli bro when Stephen Harper was prime minister. Justin Trudeau vowed a more nuanced Palestine-friendly policy. Trudeau's foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland, vowed Canada would be Israel's asset at the UN Security Council. In the Canadian Parliament, Mark Carney, now prime minister, sturdier voices are demanding justice and action. With me to talk about this is the Honourable Mary Lou McFedrin, Canadian senator from the province of Manitoba. In late June, Senator McFedrin and 10 of her colleagues called on Prime Minister Carney to uphold international law and hold Israel accountable. We reached Senator Mary Lou McFedrin on summer leave in British Columbia. Hello, Mary Lou McFedrin. Hello, Senator McFedrin. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor. Tell me about this statement that you folks, you and 10 of your colleagues, released on June 25th. And you've just told me that you've just today, the 29th day of July, just released another statement. But for the moment, tell me about the statement you released on 25th of June and what you're asking, respectfully, that Prime Minister Carney do.
I'd like to begin, David, by acknowledging the heartfelt, dedicated work of Senator Pao Wu of British Columbia on this issue, particularly with a focus on starving and murdered Palestinian children. Senator Wu was the host for the special rapporteur, the UN special rapporteur, Albanese, to come to the Senate. And it was at a time prior to our releasing the joint statement on June 25th, when I think it's fair to say that there was a level of concern, but not a level of action on the part of most of our colleagues in the Senate on this issue. And that is shifting. And as it happens, the 25th of June, the day we released the previous letter, because as you've mentioned, we released another one today in the morning in Canada. And on the 25th of June, that turned out to be our last day in Parliament before the Prime Minister declared that we were adjourning for the summer. And those of us, the 11 of us who ended up signing that joint statement, and I'll just say that we don't get that many joint statements coming out of the Senate of Canada. There is a strong sense among many that the tradition of the Senate should have a somewhat removed positioning on the part of senators in Canada. We're referenced sometimes as being the place of sober second thought, being the place where there should be, as some people put it, some neutrality on issues until they've been carefully studied by senators. And that may be one of the reasons that a significant number of our colleagues, we now have over 100 sitting senators, and why a significant number of our colleagues may have felt concerned but were not prepared to put their names to this letter. The letter we released today has a more of a focus. The letter that we released at the on the last day of Parliament in June was very much geared to the need to tell more of the truth about what's really going on, and in particular to focus on the impact of children. We had come from a seminar where a number of non-governmental organizations, civil society leaders focused on children, UNICEF being one, Save the Children being another, had come to the Senate. And we had quite a turnout. We had about 25 senators that showed up for this in-person briefing where they focused on ways in which Canada had spoken out and taken action to support children in Ukraine in the midst of that illegal war, and compared that to the relatively much less of both a response in words and a response in action and a response in funding when it came to Palestinian children, Gaza, children in Gaza. And that prompted us to do this joint statement to bring to the attention of the government of Canada that there needed to be much more action and many more resources directed to the children of Gaza. So that was the June statement. This statement, roughly a month later, is geared to calling attention to the government of Canada and to those who care about what the government of Canada is or should be doing in relation to Gaza, where our joint statement pointed out, and we built on a report that was also released this morning in Canada, basically contradicts what we've been told previously by officials representing Global Affairs Canada around what we've allowed in terms of arms and arms-related items to be sent to Israel, either routed through the U.S. to end up in Israel or sent directly to Israel.
Because Canada has a certain arms trading relationship with Israel, doesn't it? Canada sends arms and security equipment to Israel, and it receives arms and certain kinds of securitization technologies from Israel.
That's right. And also, Canada is a state party to the Arms Trade Treaty. So we have no business in terms of our legal obligation to allow this to continue to happen. And part of what we as senators were raising in this joint release today was, and again, the focus was on children in Gaza, is on children in Gaza. But because of the new evidence, the carefully researched evidence that was released from the coalition of NGOs, we really wanted to weigh in on that because, of course, why do we have this escalating, this tragic and horrific escalation of the death of people in Gaza who are just trying to get food, and the disproportionate impact on children. So, of course, it's related to military exports to Israel. And this report that was released today is a very clear demonstration of both complicit companies who are involved in this.
Canadian companies
and Israeli companies. So it names Israeli companies that are receiving Canadian exports, military exports. And the research looked at the data tables for imports from Canada in Israel. And it covered from October 2023 to June of 2025. So very much up to date. And for the first time, complementary shipping records and government data provide the most detailed public snapshots to date of Canada's military support for Israel's assault on Gaza. And this evidence is a contradiction of what Canadian officials have been telling the world.
What military equipment is Canada sending to Israel?
It's not necessarily guns.
It's components.
It's components.
Specializes in components, doesn't it?
Yeah. So the general term is military exports. And, you know, for me, I'm those details of exactly what those military exports are is really not the point here. The point is that there is documented evidence that what we were told, which was that we had stopped. The previous foreign minister said that we had stopped sending military exports to Israel.
That was Melanie Joly.
Yes, the previous foreign affairs minister. So now I think we have to look to the current foreign affairs minister, the Honorable Anita Anand, to see just what amount of honesty we're going to get from the government of Canada.
Can you give me a sense, Senator McFadden, like, did you have any understanding of specifically what kinds of components, military components, Canada is sending to Israel?
Well, the report from civil society, which we have as senators taken very seriously, the restricted arms exports to Israel, and what's listed here is 47 shipments with detailed commercial shipping records uncovered from manufacturers in Canada selling military-related components to Israeli weapons companies between October 2023 and July 2025, including 421,070 bullets exported to Israel, 3 shipments of cartridges from the General Dynamics Ordnance and Tactical Systems, and 391 shipments, including bullets, military equipment, weapons, parts, aircraft components, and communication devices.
Huh.
Huh.
So you've got 6 asks here on June 25th protect UNRWA, ensure that UNRWA is funded, imposing a two-way arms embargo on Israel. Okay, I think we've touched on that. End Canadian involvement in illegal Israeli settlements. I mean, Canada.